IMU, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, has been a lot in the news recently. Afghan officials say in most cases they are the ones responsible for recent insurgency in northern Afghanistan. Across the border, Central Asians say the group is posing threat to the entire region. On the top of these alarming news came another headline this month in the announcement by Osman Ghazi, leader of IMU, declaring union with the IS militants in Iraq and Syria. So the question is, are we faced with fresh comeback by IMU, or is it an empty threat? Hello, I am Mohammed Tahir. Welcome to the Majlis. Originally founded in Uzbekistan over the last 15 years, the organization is driven out of its origin. Since then, faced to survive in difficult conditions in Afghanistan, later in tribal areas of Pakistan, and now who knows where. Therefore, having disconnected from its origin, many thought it's a broken organization, no more focused on its original mission. In fact, it's a group of people trying to find ways to survive wherever they can. But that's not the case when you hear Afghan officials. And also, recent announcement of Osman Ghazi, who once more spoke about the objective of the organization with determination. Now, how to understand the organization, its capacity and intention in light of recent developments? Today, we aim to discuss this subject with all of its details. To do so, I have some of the best experts on the subject: Alisher Siddiq, director of RFRL Uzbek Service; Sirojiddin Tolipov, who has just joined our Uzbek Service with background in BBC; also, as always, Bruce Panier, who is editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's begin with this. How significant is the recent announcement by Osman Ghazi to incorporate IMU to IS? Alisher?
Significant to IMU itself. So from now on, we can say there is no such thing as IMU. So probably this is the last discussion when we mention the name IMU, because they no more call themselves that way. So the organization was completely merged, as much as I can understand from conversation with them. So as you know, they contact us, they try to explain what they're doing. So now they gave up leadership to al-Baghdadi and his representative in so-called Khorasan region, the region which covers the whole Central Asia, part of Pakistan, Afghanistan. So it's a vast region they are claiming to relieve from so-called infidel groups and non-believers. The IMU, in that sense, is coming back to its original claim. The original claim was to establish caliphate in this vast region. Though for the past several years, they've been fighting in Pakistan against forces of Pakistani army. And now they're back and fighting the different war. The different war, which has more meaning to them particularly, and to other new recruits possibly. So by aligning with the Islamic State, IMU possibly, according to experts, will be capable of engaging more recruits, new recruits, new extremistic youth, you know, those young people who would be more keen. Because in the previous war against Pakistani forces, it was quite a challenging issue, you know. You hardly find anyone who would want to fight the war without obscure meaning. You know, now the meaning is to fight the jihad, real jihad, as they put it, and to help the bigger Islamic State in Syria and Iraq to establish their own governance on the region in Central Asia and what they call Khorasan.
Right. Colleagues, please jump in if you want to add something in opinions which is just expressed, or agree or disagree. Does al-Baghdadi cares about IMU joining them? Is it important for them?
You see, Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan was forced, in fact, to join Islamic State because of this economic and financial difficulties they faced. Over the last few years, the financial support which was supplied from the Gulf countries almost cut in half. And they didn't have enough money just to survive even. After the events in Pakistan, in attack on Peshawar airport, and then before that, the attack on Lal Masjid, everything has shown that the Islamic movement Uzbekistan almost lost its the capacity, their will to survive forced them to join Islamic State. Financially, it was very difficult. When I spoke to a former IMU fighter who was staying in Turkey, he told me that it doesn't matter where they, for them, and where to stay, either in Pakistan, Afghanistan, or Syria. The most important part for them, thing for them, is to be in a holy war, in a jihad against infidels.
And I also absolutely agree that this is very important for al-Baghdadi himself. You know, why would he send his own AD, Said Hafiz, to get this allegiance from IMU? You know, it's he's quite, on the videos that we obtained, it's clearly visible how he made a speech in front of IMU people, and he shook their hands, and there was kind of festivity around this joining. So IMU is by itself is a brand, right? I mean, for many years it's branded as the, you know, it's branded by Americans as terrorist organization, which it is. In the extremistic circle, in radical circle, this is a group which fights for Islam, you know, basically for jihad. But now it's joining another new brand, which is like, if you will, make it very simple. You know, you have a older iPhone, like iPhone 5, and now you got the latest iPhone 6. You know, it's like a brand new organization, and they if you're part of a brand new organization, you have better chance, as my colleague says, to get military help, financial help, the possibly, you know, all this political help which comes with it. And another very important issue, I know I'm taking too much time probably. IMU has been very much in disagreement with Taliban, which they claim in their statements become more nationalist, more pro-Pashtun type of nationalists. They kind of put this in their statements. IMU is a very international organization. I mean, it's very international. You have all nations of from Central Asia. You have Chechens. You have Afghans themselves, and they view Islamic State as the identical international state, kind of identical international organization, which can accommodate them much better than by any other groups in Afghanistan or in Pakistan.
We in the West would like to consider IMU a kind of a dismantled organization trying to survive here and there out of money and out of motivation. But the way you put it, Alisher, is it seems that they are a well-organized group. They can think strategically. They can take strategic decisions. Did I understand you correctly?
IMU, like, it's more like a ideology, you know. Islamic State is more ideology than a structural organization. So the ideology which sucks the youth with any kind of a, how do you say, endeavor or like to fight for something, you know. And you in our region you'll find thousands and thousands of such people, young people who want to fight some jihad, you know. Doesn't matter, you know, they believe in it. And they just need a playground where they can play this game. So IMU, by aligning with IS, is offering this like a new playground. And it doesn't matter whether you can suppress the group militarily now, you know, but the ideology will still be there. So it's just a return of a new, more horrific, more dangerous ideology in the region.
Russ?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, of course, I read reports about, you know, Usman Ghazi swearing allegiance to Islamic State. And what's never been clear to me in the recent months with the fighting going on in North Afghanistan is how many people are actually listening to Ghazi and how many people actually can even hear his message. Because the reports we get from Northern Afghanistan all agree, it's all anecdotal, but everyone seems in agreement that there are these Uzbeks, Tajik fighters that came from the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan who have suddenly shown up. But they haven't raised the black flag, and they don't use that propaganda when they're out there in the north. So it's a real question as to who they're actually aligned to. Now, we know that there have been isolated cases where people claiming to be members of the IMU have indeed said, we are members of the Islamic State. But in the north, we haven't really seen that. very much. And we know that they're mixed with the Taliban. Now, the Afghans will say that they're fighting under the Taliban leadership in the north.
Yeah.
We've heard from people that we've talked to that the opposite is true. The Taliban are fighting under the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan leadership.
Oh, lots of confusing things.
Yeah. Right. So, but there's no one in northern Afghanistan really has said so much that these foreign fighters who they identify as the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan are actually have actually sided with the Islamic State militant group. So it's unclear to me what these fighters in the north, who they're serving exactly. And to follow that up a little bit more, Usman Ghazi, now I don't know very much about him. I never heard his name until he became the leader.
We will talk about this in the second half of the program.
Okay, yeah. But again, I'm not sure. Every time that a leader of the IMU has been killed, there's been a split within the organization, going way back to 2001 when Juma Namangani was killed. So it's entirely possible that there's a core element that is commanded by Ghazi that is going to obey this, and we haven't seen, I know Furqan.com, the website, has put up stuff that basically goes along with what Ghazi said. But based on what I see in northern Afghanistan, it's not clear to me that message has been heard or at least is being obeyed in northern Afghanistan by these IMU fighters who are still fighting alongside the Taliban. And of course, the Taliban have declared the Islamic State to be their enemy, just like the infidels. So it's a very strange mixture. You know, it's a kind of a balancing act that some of these IMU guys seem to be doing, where maybe they're listening to what Ghazi is saying from his lair in Pakistan, but at the same time, the reality on the ground is they're with the Taliban, so they don't seem to be speaking up very much about
obviously,
that.
Obviously, we will talk about those contradictory situation on the ground, but also there is something more which is not clear to me. For example, IMU now part of IS, and they are, as we understand from our sources, that IMU is mainly based in northern Afghanistan. How it's going to work? IS being somewhere in Syria or Iraq, there is not a proper communication, there is no traffic. How this organization is going to work? How this union is going to work? Who wants to jump in?
I'm sure there are other ways of communication. It's not that difficult. If you compare with 1990s and now, it's the electronic wire is so developed that it's very easy. Viber, Telegram, and they're very, very sophisticated on that sphere. They have the ways of communication, and I'm sure they have messengers as those who travel a lot from Turkey to Syria, and from Turkey to Iran and Afghanistan.
But you need something more than messengers, more than telephones to be able to work together, function together, and to follow your objectives, is it?
But you see, so if you compare with Islamic State, Islamic State is not organization. They created a system which almost has capacity of a state function, a self-efficient functioning state. In Syria, so they have their own networks, tax system, justice system, whatever you just call them. It's the military system, payment, and they have a lot of supporters as well. If you compare with Al-Qaeda, there is a huge difference. Al-Qaeda did not have that capacity. They did not have a territory. But Islamic State has that capacity. They have a huge territories under their control in Syria and Iraq. And Turkey, there are a lot of people who are loyal to Islamic State. They can easily travel from Central Asia, from Russia, from Gulf countries to Turkey, neighboring countries to Syria, and just enter to that territory. I know many Uzbek Central Asians who just escaped persecutions from Uzbekistan, and they don't know where to go. If they go to Russia, they can't be easily arrested and extradited back to Uzbekistan. So they prefer go to Turkey, find a way, find the cells, and join Islamic State order just to survive and have their own life. And in that case, in this way, I can say that there are ways of communication, and
communication is obviously developed, and also militants are using that. We see in day-to-day business here in Radio Free Europe when we are covering those militants, and also
counter communication systems also do a little bit. And one of the, Alisher, I'm coming to you, besides question about the communication, the organization, how it's going to work with the, you know, IMU in Afghanistan and IS in Iraq. And you also mentioned that one reason of IMU joining IS is also to take some financial advantages. And from our today's editorial meeting, our Tajik colleagues were saying that even the Tajiks who are already in Syria are asking money from migrant workers in Russia. So it means in terms of financial situation of IS, I do not see if they are really in a position to help them much.
Right. I mean, you're kind of trying to drag us into a very unknown territory, which is like how they are being financed. You know, there are lots of conspiracies and lots of theories about it. So there's a drug issue. They possibly selling drugs to finance them. You know, they do take hostages. They loot places where everywhere. So they have the way to survive, and this group have been surviving for over decades. So if all what we think about the finance, they should have run out of finance like many years ago. But somehow they are there, you know, and I don't know specifically, and they would never reveal to you what's the means of their survival there. I think the food is not an issue, and the arms, it was always plentiful in that region in Afghanistan. You can always get the arms from soldiers, which from Pakistani army, they got something. So they have even handmade arms. They showed off some handmade rocket grenades, how they done it with these welding things. So they kind of surviving in a way. These are extreme people. They're under extreme situation. They also post a lot of videos of fights. And during those fights, I haven't noticed any lack of arms in their hands. You know, they have all these grenade-propelled arms. They have automatic arms, grenades, everything. So they're fully equipped. You know, I haven't seen any bare feet guy walking around. Maybe this is propaganda videos, but still, you know, I didn't get a feeling that they are lacking the means to fight their cause. So maybe this is maybe they could have done more if they have some better equipment, but this is as much as they can do, you know, at this point. And these arms, I think, pretty enough to their local agendas, you know, to get this village, to get the control of that village. So for their small purpose, that's pretty much enough. For the bigger purpose, you know, you come to Uzbekistan, or, you know, you sort of breach the borders, you clash with the real armies of Central Asia, or with Russian army, with US army, that might not be enough, of course. But for the smaller agendas, this is pretty much there.
I remember in the end of 1990s, when the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan first made its action by taking several Japanese geologists as hostages. But I spoke to IMU member who was in that team, and he said that they managed to get $5 million from the Japanese government in order to release these geologists. These were the first funds they had, serious funds. And they started to spread out this money. So when they crossed it from Tajikistan after a peace deal was agreed between Tajik government and opposition, they crossed into the northern part of Afghanistan and stayed in the camps in Talqan, in Takhar areas. And then they started their own business. They bought trucks, huge trucks, camions. They set up shops, exchange offices, money exchange. And they started organize things pretty much well, and they had support from the Taliban government till the American invasion in 2001. So they had money, they had the communication system, they had network, and just because of that they survived for so many years. And plus, of course, support, huge support from the rich Gulf countries.
Bruce, is it the way you see that? I mean, it's just we are faced with
kind of extreme situation here.
Well, I mean, certainly these are all parts of the puzzle. You know, Alisher mentioned the illegal narcotics trade. And in Batken in 1999, when the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan first appeared, I went down, and a lot of people knew who Juma Namangani was in southern Kyrgyzstan, but they didn't know him as the commander of the IMU. They knew him as the biggest drug trafficker between northern Afghanistan and southern Kyrgyzstan. During the years when, after the Taliban had been ousted, following the U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan, the Taliban depended on the IMU to keep those drug routes open because they had all the contacts in Central Asia. So the IMU has not lost those contacts at all. Can they make enough money, you know, to survive? Absolutely. Through the drug trade? Without a doubt they can, and they always have. And I imagine that's why so many of them are in northern Afghanistan now. That's probably their major source of income at the moment. For spreading their purpose, maybe it won't be enough, but they certainly, and Russia's Federal Anti-Narcotics Agency has said this for more than a decade now, that the IMU is running the drug trade into Central Asia out of Afghanistan, and it's it's sufficiently lucrative that they are able to fund themselves on their own for now, and like I said, those connections have not been lost over the years or even recently. If anything, they've grown stronger, and certainly evidence from just the last few months along the Tajik-Afghan border suggests that drug trade is still flourishing. In the last week, they've shot a couple of Afghans trying to get across large amounts of narcotics. I'm talking, you know, over 100 kilos of narcotics at a time. So the drug trade's still active, and it's still able to fund this group on some level.
And one thing to be also mentioned, I mean, those who join them, they're not after getting rich or something. This is like ideological thing. They can run without food for days, and they're not paid, of course. So these are extreme guys, really tough guys. So on the other hand, how do they communicate with the IS on the other side in Syria and Iraq? This is a very important issue, I think. But my vision, my view on it is that look how many Uzbeks and Central Asians in Syria and Iraq now. You know, you have, I don't want to say thousands, maybe let's say hundreds at this point. And these are people who are not from IMU. I mean, these are alternative line, you know, timeline, if you want. So these are different people from Russia, from labor migrants who were really got into this brand, this ideology. They believed in this ideology. What IMU is doing is very simple thing. They're just opening the same shop, like giving the alternative for those in Russia. If you can't go to Syria and Iraq, there's the same war going on here. Come and join us. Sort of like you're giving the opening doors for the same people with the same ideology, for these people who would go to Iraq and Syria. There is another alternative to come to Afghanistan and to fight the same type of war.
Right. So we should not forget another point. Since they left Central Asian Republic, say in 1999, let's say, so 16 years passed since then. Those childs were born in Uzbekistan or in Afghanistan, now grown-up soldiers. They haven't seen anything but military camps, Quranic courses in tribal areas in Pakistan. They've grown up and they don't know anything but how to fight and how to become shaheed. It is new generation. It's not the previous generation which hated Karimov system in Uzbekistan. These are the young children, young boys, young people with a little knowledge of Central Asia, but with huge experience on war, on guerrilla war. They speak several languages, including Pashto, Urdu, Dari. They don't speak Russian anymore. They speak some Uzbek, of course, but it's a new generation, new face of Islamic movement of Uzbekistan.
And let me jump on another thing. I know you want to ask another question, but this is very important.
I just want to take a break, but yeah, please.
Yeah, that's a very important issue. You know, in Afghanistan, there are, among Taliban, there are a lot of IS sympathizers, like thousands of people who would want to join IS instead of remaining with Taliban. So even by opening this shop as IS, so they will be able to drag those among other military groups who would sympathize IS into their own group. They will unite more. They will bring more from Taliban, those who would want to join IS. They will bring more from Russia, those who would want to join IS. So this group, I think, really made a strategic decision of survival.
In the next half of the show, we will obviously talk about, from one hand, with this decision, they might be able to bring some guys from Afghanistan into their lines. On the other hand, they also will attract big enemy, which is called Taliban, because Taliban is an open confrontation with the IS. Let's take a break here, and we will continue our discussion in the second half of the program. Welcome back to the Majlis. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the show, joined by Alisher Sadiq, director of Uzbek Service, also from Uzbek Service, Sirojiddin Tolibov, and Bruce Panier from our central newsroom. In the first half of the show, we tried to understand why the leader of IMU, Osman Ghazi, did what he did. And now let's dig into Ghazi himself. Who is this guy? Who does he speak for? Does he speak for everyone in IMU, or maybe he's one of the guys, Rajitin, you mentioned, that who grown up in outside of Uzbekistan and without much idea of Uzbekistan. So who is this guy? Where he came from? What his ideology, his thinkings are?
We don't know too much about him, but all we know that he is from Tashkent, the capital of Uzbekistan, and he grown up in an educated family. It's typical Soviet family, and he was not a popular figure or well-known figure even in among the IMU fighters. So from the rank of ordinary soldier, he became the leader. And there is not much known about Osman Ghazi.
Yeah, he was born in 1970, as Sirojiddin said, so he's from Tashkent. We know some information from the interview which was given by Uzbek national security official Mikhailov to a website, EuroAsianNews.info. So this is a website also which is believed to be controlled by National Security Service of Uzbekistan. The guy has something to say about him, like he was not very much respected, but he was from the very beginning with IMU. When he was 30, he left Uzbekistan to Tajikistan. There he joined IMU, Tahir al-Dash. So he learned everything. Then he moved on to Afghanistan and then with Taliban. So to be so many years with the group, you have to be really smart to stay alive. So I think he was one of those guys who would not be very much engaged personally in heavy wars. So he survived all these years without being killed. It's already tells about him like a smart ass guy, you know. And now even the expert continues that he, even now as a leader of IMU, he is not in the front line. He always takes a different lifestyle, unlike his predecessors. You know, Adil or Tahir al-Dash himself. So following his speeches, I think he gaining some charisma. His speeches are not maybe so much religiously rich. He cannot quote out of Quran so much as Tahir al-Dash used to do that. But his messages are very clear, very simple. And I think those who surround him are simple people, and they kind of very simple messages. Whatever he says in a very, you know, in a very short sentences, in a very Tashkent style, you know, like
with Tashkenti accent, idiomas is Tashkenti, you know.
And Tashkent style is like, you know, do it, you know, like this type, you know, let's do it, you know, like it's more attractive, I think, rather than, you know, saying something kind of with a hint. He's not hinting, he just says what he want to say, you know, in all his speeches.
You outlined in some of the things that which differs him from the previous leadership in IMU. Is it a kind of a strategic decision to have someone like that? I mean, I'm also questioning, how does this election or selection process takes place there?
You know, when Usman Ghazi came to power, like to the leadership, we've seen most horrible things, you know, like beheading in IS style. So he acquired a lot of IS style. So he was apparently someone who wanted the group to be really brutal, you know, very harsh, and showing all this to the public, you know.
As much as you are brutal, so you're respected so much among the jihadists, especially in Islamic State.
Bruce,
I wanted to talk about Ghazi earlier. You know, of course, I'd never heard of him until Usman Adil was killed, and I found out that it was his deputy, and that's why he got the position. Of course, he was working in an environment where Mullah Fazlullah came to power also, so it might not be such a mystery that his tactics, to a large extent, are similar to the ones that Mullah Fazlullah has been using with Tariq-i-Taliban in Pakistan. But the thing that strikes me even to this day about Ghazi is he's really not the original leaders. I mean, Jumana Mangani and Tahrir Yoldash had this legend behind them, almost not even a myth, really. I mean, because it could prove the stuff. Jumana Mangani was a Red Army soldier that went with forces into Afghanistan. He had a change of heart when he went there. He fought with the Islamic opposition in Tajikistan during the Civil War. He had this whole story that went behind him. Tahrir Yoldash, well known for lecturing President Karimov in Namangan in 1991, with a microphone and having Karimov sit there and
he was
explain.
22 or 23 then.
Yeah, so, I mean, and we know from stories about Tahrir Yoldash that he knew the Quran sufficiently that he could pull out hadith and other sayings from the Quran at the right time. He would make a speech to people and then he would punctuate his message with something out of the Quran all the time. He was, reputed to be very charismatic in his speaking to the people. Whereas Ghazi just seems to be a non-entity. He came out of nowhere. All right, we've heard that at least he's very clear and straightforward, but he's not dynamic like these other, like the original leaders were. I mean, the original leaders were someone, if you knew their history, you could kind of understand why people would gravitate toward them and have some faith in them. Whereas Ghazi is kind of an unknown, and that's why I've been having a hard time figuring out. I hear what he's saying. I'm just not sure who's listening to it, because I'm not sure what the attitude of the rank and file IMU soldiers is toward him, because they probably don't know very much about him either.
In my opinion, Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, Usman Ghazi and several hundred survived soldiers of IMU, they just want to draw attention by attacking, several police checkpoints in the north parts of Afghanistan. The attention of big jihadi groups like, of course, the Islamic State.
Sure, but what is the number of size of that group who is listening to him in doing what he's
so far, everybody's attention is in Syria or Iraq. It's Afghanistan has always been the hell for many years, for decades. And when you hear that 10 people died, were killed in Afghanistan, no one cares. But when you say it's one person died in Russia, so everybody speaks. So Afghanistan was always hot point. Now, many people, even in Afghanistan, don't know that they exist in northern parts of Afghanistan, you see. But it is a threat for Central Asian regimes, especially Uzbekistan.
Sure, they say so. But as I understand, Usman Ghazi lacks all of the charisma, knowledge that his predecessors had. But for some reason, he came to the leadership position. So my question is he in a position to pose a threat? Because to be able to do so, you need to have credibility and a sizable number of people listening to you. Do we know how many people are behind him?
Tohir, I mean, this is the, like, we would repeat ourselves again. So the guy took strategic decision to align with Islamic State. Means that he compensate the lack of his own charisma, the lack in his ranks, the lack of finance and military with the brand new IS. So there will be some compensation. Something will come out of it. And I'm quite disagree with the fact that Taliban fights IS. So it's not so visible in Afghanistan at this point, because Taliban is pretty much preoccupied with their leadership crisis. So even there, they're not even, Taliban is not very much sure about what to do with the IS, because it's also split, you know, they don't offer one story, go and kill IS people in Afghanistan. So there are fights in some, you know, particular regions with IS people, but there's no kind of a all-out war between Taliban and IS supporters in Afghanistan. On the other hand, what Bruce said, they cooperate with each other in north, so where they are mixed with local Uzbeks. So this is very complex situation. It's ideal time for Ghazi to make this decision, because Taliban would not take care of it so much at this point. So, and for the future, I think these guys will be able to come to strike a deal with Taliban on mutual coexistence, because it could be very difficult to strike a deal between Taliban and the government on the coexistence, but it's much easier, it's much easier between extremist groups to come to some agreement.
But you see,
there might be. I mean, again, what Taliban are you talking about here? There are in north, if they are working with together with the IMU, in the south, they are criticizing the Taliban in the name of the Taliban. Some people are criticizing what actions.
This is like a rhetoric, you know. Imagine Taliban starts killing IS people in Afghanistan, but then they have also big brothers in Iraq and in Syria as well. You know, this is like you don't want to really mess with all these things. So, you know, I think at some point. It's just my speculation, probably. They will come to agreement on coexistence, and Usman Ghazi is kind of dispersing his group and merging with IS. He himself, as a personality, will be secondary personality. He gave up the sort of the leadership. So he will use the rhetoric from Baghdadi, and he will be telling the story which he would get from Baghdadi and Syed Hafiz to his militants. So he just changed the whole game. You know, we've been playing one game, now it's a different game.
So talking about the relationship between IS and Taliban. Taliban wants to be the sole player, actor, on the Afghan scene.
They don't like to see IMU or IMU IS. Or IS. Yeah.
But yeah. If they are forced, they may say, yes, okay, you can also be here, but smaller player. So this might be the ideal for Taliban, because they don't want to lose that authority or power. They believe that Afghanistan or Pakistan belong to them, not ISIS.
Can we say at this moment, why I'm saying that, there is some groups among the Taliban who might be working with IMU, some are against IS, therefore against IMU. And there are some Uzbek groups in Syria called Maktabul Bukhari, something?
Katibatul Bukhari.
Katibatul Bukhari, and they are also fighting against IS in Syria. I cannot entirely disconnect people in fighting in the name of IMU and these guys in Syria, the Uzbek militants. In that case, too, they are in coalition course against each other. I mean, are we talking about different types of IMU, different types of...
You can say so. So they are not part of the IMU anymore. These are the two groups which split up IMU over the past several years ago. How it happened? Those groups, Jabhat al-Nusra, the Katibat al-Bukhari, who are now in Syria... there are several hundred of them. Approximate number is around 300. They are Salafis, Wahhabis. But the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan has always been proud of being Hanafi. Even Tahrir al-Dash didn't like Wahhabis. So that was the main point of disagreement. They just left Islamic movement of Uzbekistan without any fight. Three main commanders left, and their supporters also joined them, and they decided to go to Syria.
And I just got a message, so it looks strange, but I got a message from IMU, now IS. So they say, we received the fatwa, like the order, to kill Salahuddin. Haji Yusuf
Salahuddin is the commander,
commander of Bukhari,
Katibat al-Bukhari.
And they can do it. I mean, this is their ability is could not be so much diminished. You know, the killings in Turkey, all this stuff. So it's an old group, very much known in extremistic circles. So they just getting more powerful and getting more dangerous. And I think just to diminish their the danger by saying they're not big in number or their finances are uncertain or anything like this. This is I think this is not serious talk, because even from what we hear from the whole environment makes them even more powerful. Taliban is preoccupied. Americans would leave the region, so this group can make a really strong comeback, I think, in the next few years.
How do you see next few years, Bruce?
I will wrap it up. Although I also have to note that this isn't a call-in show, so that's actually the first call that we've had during our show, and that's a heck of a way to start. You know, obviously the situation in Afghanistan is playing a big role in this. You know, I'll support what Ali Shir was saying earlier that you know, Qasim has made two statements about the IS that we know of. He made one last year in September, and in that one he voiced support for it but didn't give the bayat. He didn't say that he was. He didn't swear allegiance to him. That just happened this month, at the end of last month. So it shows that his thinking, something's changed in his thinking, and what's changed in Afghanistan recently, and that's the big division in the Taliban itself. You know, are we going to talk peace with the government? Are we not? What's our ultimate goal and stuff? So he seems to have figured that the Taliban is sufficiently fractured at the moment. They can't harm him specifically or the IMU specifically, and that as an ally, they're not worth as much as the Islamic State is. So we're going to have to see how the Afghan conflict shakes out. Now, the Taliban are always going to be able to hold over the IMU the fact that they sheltered the IMU when the IMU needed help. That counts a lot for this kind of culture, or in this kind of culture, and they'll be able to play on those historic ties between the two groups. And there'll be a lot of people that have been in the IMU who are going to listen to that and say, yes, when we needed help, the Taliban were the people who did help us, and if they want us to stay with them, then maybe we shouldn't go. At the same time, of course, the IMU is in this to survive. And as we've heard, they have a much broader vision of a much broader goal than the Taliban. The Taliban, you know, you made the point at the start that the Taliban are essentially a nationalist movement. They want Afghanistan and part of Pakistan, but they've never said we want to conquer Iran and Iraq and all those kind of places. I mean, they've started out as a resistance movement that was more concerned with just occupying all the territory and administering the territory of Afghanistan, and now more recently some parts of Pakistan too. So until there's some clear, not resolution necessarily, but when there's some clarity to the Afghan situation, I think that the IMU is probably going to keep all its options open, and certainly as clear a channel to the Islamic State militant movement as they can.
And just my last point, I mean, these groups will continue, they're very much opportunistic. They will continue capitalizing on the fact that there is a disagreement between Afghanistan and Pakistan, capitalizing on the fact that there is the leadership crisis in Taliban. They know the whole weak points. Something to get destruction, you know, this leadership is getting distracted from the real threat, you know. In Iraq, they are using the fact that there is a leadership crisis in Baghdad or in Syria. So that's why they're surviving. I mean, because they know that you know, the countries and groups around them are all in conflict with each other, and they're kind of sneaking always between this, between these conflicts.
Here you go. Thank you very much, Alisher Sadiq, okay, and Sirojiddin Talibov from Uzbek Service, and Bruce Panier from Central Newsroom. Thank you for your thoughts and time, and appreciate it.
And dear listeners, thank you for your time to listen to the podcast. As always, we are eager to hear what you think of the subject and opinion expressed in the show. You can reach us via rferl.org or Facebook/rferl, or you can follow us on Twitter/rferl. From me, Mohammed Tahir, and from all the team in Prague, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you too. I learned a lot. I was